Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Mecklenburg's COVID-19 infection numbers are moving in the right direction despite an error in testing data. Even as parents ask CMS to begin athletic practice, the North Carolina Athletic Association cancels the fall season, including high school football. We're just 10 days away from the Republican convention in Charlotte, and news emerges about their plans and safety precautions. And school starts Monday. We have a lot of information about that and more, and here to fill us in on that and more is WFAE's Education Director Ann Doss Helms. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner is here from WBTV, where he is their investigative executive producer. Welcome back to the program.
Howdy, howdy.
Jonathan Lowe is anchor reporter for Spectrum News 1, not 2, but 1. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
And Joe Bruno is reporter for WSOC TV Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Thank you for coming back, Joe. Good to see you.
Good morning.
We're on the radio. We're also on Facebook Live. Nationally, coronavirus infections and deaths continue to climb at an alarming rate, but the trends in Mecklenburg County have left County Health Director Gibby Harris cautiously optimistic.
These numbers are moving in the direction that we want them to move in. They are moving slowly, but they are moving.
And why does she believe that's happening?
Masks are having a big impact. We are seeing more and more people wearing masks. A lot of people are complying with the requirement around masks. So I do think that that's a major part of the solution. But all of the other restrictions that are in place and the fact that we've held to phase two, I think, has also had a direct impact.
If you look at the national maps of COVID infections, North Carolina is still among the states with the second highest numbers of infections, and Mecklenburg County has long been the epicenter of it in the state. So how much of a turn are our numbers taking to give her this optimistic outlook? Who wants to take that? Joe.
You know, we never really quite hit the South Carolina, Florida, Texas levels of coronavirus, but we've always been kind of, you know, like on that edge of boiling. So for a while, we were seeing double digit percent positivity rates. And the fact that we've kind of had sustained one digit levels for 2 or 3 weeks now, that's a good sign. 7.5% is the lowest that it's been in weeks. And we're going to get another update about that today. I do think the mask mandate did play somewhat of a role in this. The question now that I have is, you know, what does success look like? When are we finally going to be able to graduate from this phase and open up some more things here? And that's something that really she couldn't put her finger quite on just yet.
Well, yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, yes, we're doing better than we were because we weren't doing great, right? But while masking, obviously, we know reduces the transmission of the virus, the other thing that reduces case counts is reduced testing. And we know that we've gone back towards reduced testing over the last week or so as we saw increased wait times, turnaround times, an increased lack of supplies again. And so, yes, we're seeing a reduction in cases because we're also seeing a reduction of people getting tested.
If I could just add, I think even Joe brought this up earlier in the week, the positivity rate and where the county may want us to get to. I think the goal of some national analysts is like 1 to 2% or even, you know, just getting to 5%. So I always wonder, you know, versus what Joe just mentioned about reopening things and how people like Secretary Cohen and you know, Health Director Harris, how they're going to juxtapose that positivity rate with us possibly reopening things and getting back to some sort of normalcy.
Because our rate is seven as of Wednesday was 7.5%, and that's down from previous weeks. But nationally, people have said that they want that number to be at 5% for reopening. And Harris has said that states that have fared better when that percentage rate is as low as 1 or 2%. So we don't know what Mandy Cohen and Governor Cooper or even Gibby Harris are using as a yardstick, do we? Do we know which percentage rate they're looking at to reopen?
No, and that's what I was trying to figure out in my questions to Gibby Harris, because she did mention 5%, which she kind of just said was a number that was put out there as like a baseline, and then she mentioned that 1 or 2% is the goal. But, I mean, we're months away from 1 or 2%, if we even get that low. That's just not realistic at this point. So I think
in fairness, everybody, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Everybody nationally says there's not one magic flip the switch number, one measure that, you know, safe, not safe, that it's a combination of trends. And we would all love to see a clear cut one, but there isn't one.
Well, that's,
and it will be interesting, Mike, to see now that schools are going back. I mean, we already see some sort of impact and increase in cases in Georgia. And it's still, you know, that fly in the ointment as far as, are kids getting this? Are they not? Are they not getting it?
They are getting it. Clearly, that's
true. Right. But that's still, people are still questioning that. Right. And so as we get more and more kids going back to school, it, you know, we'll also be looking to see if we have another increase in cases, but in kids, and kids passing it to adults.
Well, a lack of information seems to be leading to a lot of lack of understanding, and you don't know who to believe, and it's very confusing. And I understand we're all experiencing this together for the first time, including health officials. But Harris has said that she backs in-person school, meaning everybody go back to school, if positivity falls to 5%, we're at 7.5 right now. She wants it to fall to 5%. Why would she be okay with going back to school at 5% if she says that states all fare better at 1 or 2%? I don't. This is what's so confusing. Why would she be okay with that?
I think because there are benefits to children being in school. Certainly, Ann would know more about this. But I mean, at some point, the benefits of being in school outweigh the risks of virtual learning. And I think it's confusing even for the health officials, right? I mean, for Gibby Harris and Mandy Cohen and all of them, because they've never dealt with a global pandemic before. So I think it's probably them trying to figure out where is the tipping point to say this is the benefits outweigh the risks.
And Cabarrus County Schools, which is the other nearby district that went decided to go all remote, their board was very split on that. And they do have some metrics set up. CMS is still working on that. But their superintendent told me that it is, they review every 2 weeks. If it hits 5% positivity or below and cases are declining and the hospitalizations are not looking bad, then they will sort of launch preparations. They will essentially take another 2 or 3 week window and say, if things stay good, we're going to start preparing to bring kids back in that limited plan B arrangement. So nobody's saying 5% and, you know, just throw open the doors and let everybody mingle, which I don't know if that's how it was supposed to work in Georgia. It kind of looks like what happened there. Because they are saying it's going to be really important once you start bringing kids back, you know, which either happens Monday in several counties or later in some of these counties, you still got to have a lot of safety measures in. Right. And you got to be ready to potentially lock down a classroom or even a school if the spread starts.
So on Wednesday, the State Department of Health and Human Services reported an additional 1,166 cases of COVID-19, up from 1,051 reported the day before. Statewide, they're reporting 141,176 cases and 2,304 deaths. But we also learned on Wednesday that the number of total tests that the State Department of Health and Human Services has been reporting has been inaccurate. Why?
Because LabCorp, the testing and lab giant based in North Carolina, it turns out had been reporting some tests that were processed in North Carolina to as being North Carolina tests. These were processed here for home tests out of state. But those were getting recorded. The real culprit here, though, is the fact that DHHS has been taking in data both manually and electronically. And so this was a problem in the manual collection of data that they caught. This goes back to April. They didn't catch it until this week when they fixed it. I talked to Secretary Cohen yesterday and asked her specifically why are you doing manual and electronic collection still? And two, are you going to stop doing that if that's the problem? And she said they are working to improve their data collection efforts and to reduce the use of manual data collection.
So do these inaccuracies in any way affect our understanding of the impact of this disease in North Carolina?
She says it does not.
Okay.
Go ahead, Nate. Go ahead, Nate.
Yeah, she says it does not because they were still also doing the digital collection of the data, and that's what's used to populate the top line numbers we see on the dashboard. I think there's, we'll see. I'm always weary when anyone says just across the board, yes, unequivocally that this didn't impact right. anything. We do know that manual collection of data has impacted other things like reporting of outbreaks in nursing homes. And Secretary Cohn acknowledged when I asked her yesterday, she said, look, we need to do a better job of our data collection. She said they've been trying to do a better job. I think part of the problem here is that this pandemic started and, you know, made it, everyone is scrambling, but they continue to improve.
So last week, the health director of Orange County pleaded with the chancellor at UNC Chapel Hill not to resume in-person classes and not to bring students back to campus. I think that went largely ignored. This week, our health director, Gibby Harris, warned that she expects to see an increase in coronavirus cases here as colleges and universities welcome students back. She said, quote, it's an experiment. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. We do anticipate there's going to be some cases. And this echoes an op-ed piece on Thursday in The Observer from a graduate student at NC State who wrote, graduate student workers are often the first line of contact for students. We teach their courses, grade their assignments, meet with them during office hours, and tutor them outside of class. And while we are underpaid, we have not been included in decision-making concerning the fall semester. And he went on to say that university administrators make plans for activities they will not participate in and which will not affect them directly, adding, we will not be safe. There has been a lot of discussion over the years about how we use student athletes to bring money into colleges and universities. Is this too about money? Just get these kids into the classroom and the dorms so we can make money. And when health officials call bringing students back to campus an experiment, should parents, students, faculty, and staff be worried? Anne.
Well, I think everybody's worried everywhere. And there is second guessing going on in every direction. You know, the union in Gaston County for sure have decided to bring their K-12 students back on a limited basis. And there are parents and teachers who are really fighting that. Meanwhile, you have like Cabarrus and CMS at the K-12 level saying we're going to go all remote. And people are really unhappy with that. I mean, there is not a safe path here, because I don't know so much about the college level, but keeping kids home is not ideal for a whole lot of families, for their learning, for their safety, for their ability to keep kids fed and healthy. So there's just not a clear-cut, safe option for anyone.
Since there's no sports to bet on, they ought to be opening pools about how long the colleges will stay in session before they have to shut things down. That would be a way to make some extra money on the side, I suppose. Well, more bad news this week for neighbors in the Elizabeth area. The opening of the Hawthorne Lane Bridge will be delayed yet again. There have been several delays, one because the contractor ordered the wrong girders, and now inspectors have discovered the concrete they're using doesn't meet specs.
The level of incompetence on this project is breathtaking. This streetcar has just been a pain in the ass for too long, and people are sick of it.
And that is Charlotte City Councilman Larkin Eggleston, who represents the Elizabeth area. When we come back, we'll talk about whether or not this is just bad luck with this contractor, or exactly what is going on here, because we've had the girders, and I'm just curious about how confident we are about the structural integrity of this bridge as it spans, I don't know, what is it, 10 lanes across Independence Boulevard? We'll talk about that and more when we come back with Ann Doss-Helms from WFAE, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, and Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News One at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. As voters start having their say on the 2020 election, Charlotte Talks wants to hear just what it is they're saying. If you're a voter and would like to be included in upcoming shows about the election, email charlottetalks@wfae.org. Again, that's charlottetalks@wfae.org. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Nick Oxner's here from Channel 3. Joe Bruno from Channel 9. Jonathan Lowe from Channel 1. Spectrum News 1. And Doss Helms is here from 90.7 WFAE. All right. Larkin Eggleston, the city council representative from Elizabeth, I'm going to repeat the cut because I want people to comment on this. Here's what he had to say about this latest snafu on the Hawthorne Lane Bridge.
The level of incompetence on this project is breathtaking. This streetcar has just been a pain in the ass for too long, and people are sick of it.
So, is this just bad luck? What's happening here, Joe?
It's a disaster. I don't know about bad luck. It's a disaster. I don't understand how this happens. Why is the city not watching this contractor like a hawk and watching their every move to make sure that this bridge can get built? We've been building bridges forever. Right. How is it that the Hawthorne Lane Bridge has had so many problems? Has this contractor ever built a bridge before? First it was the girders. Now they're pouring the concrete incorrectly. It's been years. Like, this is unacceptable. And I think finally council members are realizing that. The problem right now I have is we have no idea what they are going to do because they are hiding behind attorney-client privilege and protecting their options against this contract.
Well, that explains why the mayor was on the program this week. That explains why she was so evasive, although she did allude to the fact that perhaps this particular contractor that the city has used before has never built a bridge. And she also brought up something else about this, that the city has very little control over one aspect of the bidding process.
Sometimes government can have regulations that don't always help us. We're required to take low bid contracts. And in this case, the contractor presented themselves as the best option. And as we couldn't disqualify
As the cheapest option.
That's it, the lowest bid option. And mm-hmm. We are required to take the lowest bid.
You mean you get what you pay for? Is that what she's saying?
Well, not when you're driving under it every day, or, you know, if you're heading inbound or outbound on Independence Boulevard. I wouldn't necessarily agree with that.
Councilman Ed Driggs has asked if council can review their bid process, not just for this, but probably because of this, to avoid issues like this in the future.
Let me point out really quickly that, you know, this Gold Line project is quite long, and there are other parts of it that are almost done. And I'll point out that the portion that is over by Johnson C. Smith that goes under Interstate 77, that's almost complete. And I don't know if it's the same contractor, but it's like, you know, why is this part? And it's not a bridge, but it's just as intricate because it's going under a bridge. It includes a 5-point intersection, and it's almost complete and ready to go. So that kind of just also is another, you know, indication of what's the problem with this bridge versus the rest of the project.
We have a comment here from a listener. I understand it's mandated by the state to go with the lowest bidder, but no homeowner would automatically go with the lowest bidder for a contractor.
Absolutely.
Are there any Etruscans who can build it? Which I think is pretty funny.
It's worth noting, Mike, that there is no attorney-client privilege from the council to their lawyers in North Carolina under the North Carolina Public Records Act. So once again, we have government officials citing laws that don't actually exist to keep the public in the dark. Shame on that.
But even Larkin Eggleston, the city councilman, says we need to do a better job of holding the people we hire to do work with us accountable.
Absolutely.
How do you do that if you don't do it publicly? Go ahead, Jonathan. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about, you know, a lot of inside baseball stuff, but and I really like to the people in this. And, you know, you talk about the people that try to get into town, first of all, that can't get across that bridge,
right.
Used to be able to get across. But there have been businesses, Mike, that have closed down,
sure.
That have tried to make it through this construction, that have had to close down. I would like to know, what is going to be the compensation for the people in that neighborhood and the businesses in that area that have been told these completion dates 3, 4, 5 times, and, you know, it continues to not come to fruition because of poor and mismanaged contracts? It's just,
Joe.
It,
There are two options that we know of that cats in the city can take. One is, first of all, the contractor has to pay for all the mistakes that they've made. That's not coming out of the taxpayer's wallet. The other is the city can assess liquidated damages, just like the state is doing with the I-77 project right now. So, you know, they can charge a certain amount per day that this bridge was not delivered. But I think what the bigger picture here is now some council members are doubting the future of the streetcar project's expansion because they want to extend it out to Eastland and out to the health department in West Charlotte. And now we have people like Councilman Larkin Eggleston saying we need to review that and see if that's the best way to spend taxpayer dollars in the future.
Well, they certainly need to change contractors. At a federal budget meeting a couple of months ago in June, CATS told them that the contractor is, quote, ineffective in project management, rail installation, and bridge construction, resulting in poor budgeting, scheduling, construction, and or quality. I can't think of more condemning words than those. And you submitted, Joe, a records request to the Charlotte City Manager, Marcus Jones, into that memo from Charlotte City Council about potential actions they might be taking against the contractor. Nothing came back, right?
Nope. They cited attorney-client privilege, okay. But you know what? Elizabeth neighbors, Plaza Midwood neighbors, and taxpayers demand more than rejecting a records request. We need to know what the city is going to do about this catastrophic failure.
And again, that's literally, it's just wrong. There is no exemption for this. They can give the records. They could also waive the privilege if they wanted to the extent it exists from the lawyer to the council, but there literally is none from the council to the lawyer under the law. And we can get into that. If the city needs a public records expert, which if they do, I'm happy to call them and explain to them.
Just a button on this, Mike. It will be interesting to talk to pedestrians and bicyclists when it's open to them later this month. Do you feel safe riding?
Well, that was going to be my next question. We have this problem with the contractor ordering the wrong girders, which stopped this project dead in its tracks for months at a time. Now we have substandard concrete that was discovered by an inspector, not by the contractor. Those are the two things we know about. What about all the things we may not know about? How do we determine, once the streetcar starts crossing this bridge on an hourly basis and cars and trucks and pedestrians and bicyclists start crossing this bridge over Independence Boulevard, how do we, can we be sure of the structural integrity of this bridge?
They're going to have to do a lot of test runs before I get comfortable driving over it or biking over it.
Okay. The Democratic National Convention starts virtually on Monday. That means we're just about 10 days away from the Republican convention here in Charlotte, mostly virtual as well. But there will be members of the GOP here doing their business meeting, and Dr. Jeffrey Runge, who is a former medical director for the Department of Homeland Security and one-time clinical research director at Carolina's Medical Center, was named the convention's senior advisor for health and safety planning.
We're jumping through some significant hoops in order to carry on a meeting where that is COVID negative and that provides no risk to the community.
So what precautions have they put in place?
I think the biggest thing
going to be like it's kind of going to be like the NBA bubble. Like, they're going to keep everybody in the Westin, and they're going to try to minimize movement as much as possible. They're going to mandate masks. They're going to require a COVID-19 test before they get to Charlotte. And they're also going to be wearing a safety fob that will keep track of every single person they come in contact with who's also wearing a safety fob. And that way, if they later test positive, they'll have all that information for the health director to contact trace, and our contact tracers won't get over.
Now, I commented on this earlier this week and got a really vitriolic response from a listener who said they're never listening again because of my bias. But I brought up the fact that some of the president's most ardent supporters, and this is a fact, if you don't like the facts, I can't help you, but some of the president's most ardent supporters find wearing a mask to be intrusive, unnecessary, and an infringement on their freedoms. So is anybody policing the wearing of these masks among the people coming here from the GOP and the wearing of these fobs that are supposed to provide access to contact tracing?
And we tried asking that this week, how, you know, even though they say there's going to be a mask mandate, how they plan to enforce it. And I don't know if anybody else was able to get an answer from RNC officials. but we certainly weren't. And we reached out multiple times to get an answer to that question. And I don't even think, you know, they plan to answer that part of whether it will be enforced.
And we, so, one of the things we've wondered about is, it's one thing to say you have these fobs while you're in the actual business meeting, but as they go out afterward and potentially mingle in Charlotte nightlife, are they going to be keeping those fobs, and are they going to be helpful?
These fobs attached to some kind of identification badge that you have to have to get into the sessions, or are they just a separate device that they have to wear on their belt or something?
I don't think you need the badge to get into sessions, but I do believe it is some sort of like lanyard or fob that they have to wear.
So
Dr. Runge's presentation to City Council was pretty thorough, and it did not sound political at all. And he acknowledged that this is a high risk event, and they're just trying to do everything they can to keep the risk as minimal as possible.
And there are 350 people coming from all over the country. It's a far cry from the 50,000 people that were scheduled to come here had all things been normal. And Dr. Runge did say the delegates coming here know they're coming for business and not a party.
This pandemic stinks for everybody. And, there's nothing great about this. Everything is a compromise. Our delegates certainly don't like coming to town and not having, you know, the typical celebration over a presidential candidate. There won't be, the pep rally feeling of that both conventions have, you know, every 4 years, and they don't like that.
So given the cut down size of this convention, does anybody know what police security will be like? And we know in the 2012 Democratic convention, because so many people were here, that Uptown became essentially convention central and you couldn't get in or out very easily. We won't need to do that this time because it's all going to be at the convention center. But do we know what the police presence will be like? And do we know how this will impact people coming and going in downtown Charlotte?
There's not going to be a lockdown in the way that we would have expected for the RNC pre-pandemic. Protesters, they can basically go where they are going to go. So I think this will be a significantly decreased interruption to everyone else's life.
So the business meeting, I don't know how long that will take, but do we know once that is over, once they do whatever business they're conducting here, that will there be anything else about this convention to cover news-wise in Charlotte?
John? Probably not.
Probably not. And now it is time for yet another edition of...
Where in the world is...
Donald Trump's speech.
Yep. We know it probably won't be in Charlotte. It won't be here. The president has mentioned he'd like to do it at the White House and claims he is exempt from the Hatch Act, which prevents officials using official buildings for political events, though others dispute that. And now he's saying, or for a while he was saying, that he might do it at the Gettysburg, Pennsylvania battlefield where Lincoln made the Gettysburg Address. Some people have problems with that, too. Among them, presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, who told CNN that location is deeply inappropriate and an utterly terrible idea.
It's all a bit nutty. I mean, here is Donald Trump defending Confederate monuments, staying up, refusing to strip the name of rogue traitors like Bragg from federal courts, now talking about speaking at Gettysburg. Remember, not giving a speech there about public policy, but self-aggrandizing himself, making that the center of the Republican National Committee. The middle of the battlefield and cemetery at Gettysburg. I can't think of a worse idea.
Maybe that message sunk through because yesterday the president said he's intending now to make the speech on the White House lawn. Is that a violation of the Hatch Act?
Well, according to the U.S. Office of Special Counsel, their decision yesterday, it's not, saying that the federal law would not prohibit him from making a speech at the White House.
Why not? It's a political speech in front of an official government building. Why is that not a violation? And that's what the Hatch Act prohibits. I mean, why is that not a violation?
Mike, he kind of makes political speeches every single day in the form coronavirus press briefings. So.
Yes, I know. Yes, okay, so another norm is shattered. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, look, presidents for years, I mean decades, have been using their official office to blur the line of political events and official events, right? I mean, if you recall, what was that, in 2004, I remember President Bush going on a tour to highlight his, you know, Medicaid or Medicare expansion plans, and, you know, President Obama. This is not truly unique to President Trump, we should point out, although he might be pushing the bounds maybe more than his predecessors.
But there still is a difference between speeches, official speeches and events that take on political overtones, including the coronavirus briefings, and an acceptance speech for the nomination. That's just, that's not official business. That is campaign business.
Looking at, just real quickly, looking at the opinion from the U.S. Office of the Special Counsel, it's a two-page letter that they wrote, but basically they say, the president and vice president are not covered by any provisions of the Hatch Act. Accordingly, the Hatch Act does not prohibit President Trump from delivering his RNC acceptance speech on White House grounds. However, White House employees are covered by the Hatch Act. So there may be Hatch Act implications for those employees, depending of their on their level of involvement with the event and their position in the White House.
That's okay.
Direct quote from their opinion that they wrote yesterday.
Well, that was his decision yesterday. We'll see what his decision is today. School starts on Monday for CMS, and we all know instruction will be online. But, Ann, you say that even after Tuesday's school board meeting, 6 days before opening, there was no back-to-school report and no media briefing scheduled. How unusual is that?
It's really bizarre. I mean, if you've ever covered CMS, there is just usually a flurry of either one huge media briefing where they bring out all their staff and kind of talk about everything that's going on this year, or actually last year, which was Ernest Winston's first year of doing the back to school, there was a series of media briefings. Obviously, media briefings look different this year because we can't all go up through a school together or whatever, but there has probably never been more public interest in what is going to happen, how is this going to play out, how are all of these questions going to be answered. So I asked Monday, I said, you know, tell me when your media briefing is going to be. I want to get this on the schedule. And the chief of communications said, there will be several this week. It turns out several means zero.
So is this because of the unusual circumstances we're all living through right now? Or is it because we have a new superintendent? He's not accustomed to doing these things because it was somebody else's job before this year. What's going on?
That's really hard to say. And again, they had a school board meeting, which was streamed, and they had a very long report on their meal plan, which is certainly of interest. But as far as, you know, a detailed back to school report, the superintendent spoke for 11 minutes, kind of touched very briefly on a lot of topics, and that was it.
We'll come back and talk more about the first couple of days of school and some of the other questions that have been arising because of a lack of information when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. That's why Jonathan Lowe is here from Spectrum News One, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Nick Oxner from WBTV on your side, and Andos Helms, our education reporter here at WFAE News. And you spoke with Lawrence Brinson, the head of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Association of Educators.
When you keep educators in the dark, it just adds to the anxiety. Again, we plan our days, our units out. We send out communications to parents about what's going to happen. And it's hard to answer those questions when you don't have those answers yourself.
So let's run through the list of questions, Ann, that you believe need to be answered. How, one of them is how, if at all, CMS will notify families about COVID cases at schools. Is that not a moot point now that school is online?
No, because we have had COVID cases among faculty, among employees. We had the very first day, and that's actually what Lawrence Brinson and I were talking about in the case of that quote, because I was getting tips that, hey, school X told its staff not to report because there was a COVID case on campus, and eventually CMS did confirm that at two schools. Some employees learned about that from my story. They knew they'd been told not to report. So I did get to talk with Ernest Winston yesterday, and I pressed him on that, and he said, we are committed to making sure that employees are notified when there is a COVID case that affects situations at their campus. But I was saying, So what about some kind of public report? Obviously not names, not identifying information, you know, maybe not every single day, but a weekly report where you say we had X number of cases, they were at these schools, here's how we handled them. That seems like kind of something that the public would want to legitimately know. And he said, we're not committing to that. We're going to notify staff, but we have to balance the need to provide information with the need to prevent hysteria. So
another question, and one we've talked about when you were on the program last, was what's the latest on vacancies? Allegedly, they played a crucial role in the decision not to go back to school and to go online only. You want to know if those positions have been filled and if more people are leaving. And school board member Rhonda Cheek also seemed frustrated by this.
I am disappointed tonight that we didn't have a formal presentation about facilities, supplies, and staffing readiness.
So what are they telling you? And if nothing, why is that?
Well, again, I asked Ernest Winston about that, and he said teacher vacancies are actually lower right now than they were going into the last school year, which, you know, if teacher vacancies closed schools, we'd never get them open. There are always some vacancies.
Yeah.
He kind of said, well, yeah, we still have issues with custodians, with bus drivers, et cetera, with school nurses, which is not strictly CMS. Didn't provide a lot of numbers. The bus situation obviously is going to be really challenging when they reopen, because how do you hire bus drivers when right now they don't really have jobs?
Yeah. There's another question that you wanted answered that had to do with helping employees and working families get child care during remote learning. And you say that Iredell Statesville schools have a plan. We don't. What is it?
Well, Iredell Statesville has been working with various community partners, and in some cases, they are using some of their unused classrooms, one at a vacant school and some classrooms at a middle school, and letting other people come in and staff those for child care. They've also sent some of their unused staff, like people who are in the out-of-school suspension program, into a church to make sure there's some care in an area that doesn't have a lot of nearby care. CMS announced, Ernest Winston announced at Tuesday's meeting that there is a memorandum of understanding with the YMCA to provide care for employees. I've asked twice for that memorandum and have not gotten it.
Biggest question, how ready are students to take part in remote learning? Is that a question that's in reference to technology and or equipment, or to their mindset of being out of a classroom most of the last spring and some people going to school for the first time and never having been in a classroom? It's all going to be virtual. Is that what is that question about?
Well, I think their mindset is impossible to measure, but certainly the bare bones is the technology. And we know that this week there have been technology pickup situations where parents can drive through the school and get the CMS says we have enough laptops and for the younger kids iPads to make sure that everybody has a device. But what I was asking Ernest Winston is, okay, you have them, do the students have them? On Monday, will every student have what they need? And I don't think that that is clearly the case. He didn't flat out say no, but they said, yeah, you know, some families are easier to reach than others. You've got homeless families, you've got kids who are families who may not have transportation, you've got families who may not speak English. They say they're really trying to work with churches and other community organizations to make sure that every family knows, yes, remote school starts on Monday, and if you don't have that device, get in touch with your teacher, with your principal, we can get you hooked up.
But if you're homeless, you certainly don't have access to Wi-Fi. You don't even have access necessarily to a way to charge your device. How are they working around that?
Well, and all he said was that we are working with our principals and our McKinney-Vento, which is the department that works with homeless. I mean, not every homeless child is living on the streets. A lot of them are potentially in a motel room, living with relatives, in a shelter. So it's a very complicated piece of the puzzle. And I just think, not just CMS, but everywhere, it is not going to be 100% readiness on Monday
morning. The one thing that we do know is that CMS will be trying remote learning for pre-K children. How can that possibly work?
You know, and that was another thing that Ernest Winston just very briefly and said it twice and sort of was somewhat contradictory. So I was trying to chase that down on Tuesday night, say, what does this mean? And there is a plan in which, again, the pre-kindergartners get the technology and the parents get instructions on how to help their kids learn via online. They have said, if you can't do that, you can pick up a paper packet. But essentially, it's going to rely very heavily on the parents. the public pre-kindergarten programs are geared toward the children with the biggest challenges. Either they don't have the skills and or they're low income. So I don't know how effective it's going to be to say to these families who are already facing a lot of challenges, here, let's do online pre-K.
You got a lot of mystified. Go ahead, Jonathan.
I was going to say, I remember hearing the woman who runs MEC pre-K say last week on TV that online learning for pre-K is not an option, that they have to come into the classroom. So I don't, maybe he needs to call her and they need to talk.
Well, no, we have three separate pre-kindergarten programs, public pre-kindergarten free to parents, and two of them are doing in-person, and CMS, because they have said their buildings are not safe, are doing it remotely.
Meanwhile, Superintendent Ernest Winston, who has been vague about a lot of the things you want to know the answers to, and kicked off the year with the message about the challenge of combating structural racism in the schools. And you reported earlier this week that his approach and his recommended reading list have sparked some praise and some anger. Do tell.
So he had a 25-minute welcome video for teachers. A little less than 5 minutes in, he shifted to this topic of anti-racism and referred to the events of the summer, the trauma of seeing George Floyd murdered by police. He talked about structures that hold back students of color, and particularly Black males. And he said they're everywhere, but they are part of CMS, and we have to confront that. We have to move beyond cultural competence and really look at our own biases and our own role in keeping these bad situations going. And he had a reading list. He said over the summer he had asked principals to read and discuss two books, Ibram Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist, I may not have that exactly right, and White Fragility. And those books are very controversial nationwide. There are some people who think they are absolutely great and the best way to get people really looking and talking about their own biases and issues. And there are people who think it's basically indoctrination and this should not be going on in public schools.
Well, just as proms were canceled last spring and graduation ceremonies shifted gears last spring and end-of-year high school musicals were canceled last spring, and just as CMS parents were pushing CMS to open the fall practice for high school sports, the North Carolina High School Athletic Association announced it is postponing football until spring, with football practice beginning February 8th. Commissioner Q Tucker says the start dates hinge on COVID-19 conditions improving and that although they are committed to high school athletes playing this year, developing the schedule was a balancing act.
We want to ensure that students have the opportunity to gain the benefits from participation in education-based athletics while mitigating the risk associated with that participation.
So what has been the reaction to the postponement of high school football? This is a big deal.
Well, you know, I think it's mixed. I think there, you know, I remember covering the protests at some football. It was several different sports that were represented at that protest, but there were a number of football student athletes who play football that protested out in CMS's parking lot probably about 2 weeks ago. You know, and I have heard from and talked to some who are excited just to have the opportunity to play because they didn't know if they were even going to get that opportunity. Mm. And then there are some that are, you know, concerned that with it not starting until February, I think there's going to be something like 7 football games. And then the plan for playoffs really isn't known yet either. So still a lot of unknowns, but at least they have a roadmap. And you know, it's not just football that got their schedule, Mike. It's also the other sports and right. You know, it's all over the place.
Well, they will be playing volleyball and running cross track country. And field cross country. But the, as you mentioned, the football schedule will be truncated even when it starts. And yep. Basketball season will start December 7th and run through February 19th. Football keeps a lot of young men engaged in school. They study because they don't get to play football if they don't do well in classes. And if they're really talented, high school football is a ticket to a college education. So what might be the impact? And of course, this is not isolated to just CMS, but it's all over the country. So what might be the impact of this on kids?
Well, and that's a good question, because a lot of times those young men and those young athletes aren't just involved in some sort of football team with the, you know, school, the public school that they go to, but also there are private leagues like AAU that they also, and leagues that travel across the country. So it would be interesting, and I haven't heard yet how private athletics might be impacted or what their plans are, but hopefully there will be an option for those student athletes to maybe be involved in some sort of AAU athletics, because they can come up with their own rules. And then maybe by the time we get to February, they have been able to be in front of some recruiters, but that yet to your question is another unknown for them.
Yeah.
Because ordinarily right now they would be, you know, well into, I guess, preseason.
And
there is the option also for, and Michael Falero reported on this, athletes can move into skill development five days after they start classes, and that does include remote classes. And that's really where the focus has been within CMS. That's not a formal practice. It would be some type of workout, but there are parents and school board members saying the county has already opened its field for private sports groups to do safe, socially distanced gatherings. They're saying there's the student athletes are so committed to their teams that they are doing student-led gatherings, you know, 30 to 50 people meeting, not particularly safe and socially distanced. So they're saying, open up these Charlotte-Mecklenburg school fields for supervised workouts, and Ernest Winston says he'll have something on that very soon.
So despite what the president is saying about mail-in voting, elections officials here are stressing that it is perfectly safe in North Carolina, and you don't need a reason to vote by mail in the state. Other than the fact that you want to vote by mail, anyone can request a ballot, but thousands of people in North Carolina are receiving absentee ballot applications in the mail from the Center for Voter Information, whatever that is. Paige Gardner founded whatever that is.
We are really trying to send early as many requests for ballots as we possibly can, recognizing we're in a pandemic and recognizing people want to vote from home in a safe way.
I received one of these mail-in ballot requests from this organization. Are they legitimate?
So there's a couple things you have to look out for. I also received one. Michael Dickerson, the elections director.
Yes, he got one too.
Everyone's getting them. Make sure that the form is blank. It will be rejected if it was pre-filled out for you. Also double check that the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections or whatever your local Board of Elections' address is correct on the return envelope. And if you don't trust the mail, you don't have to put it in the mail. You can drop it off at the Board of Elections office.
Have there been any instances where these ballot applications, and that's all they are, they're not ballots, they're just a request for a ballot. Are there any indications that any of them have been filled out prior to mailing? Any indication that the addresses that you mailed them back to are incorrect?
Yes. In another state, some of the forms that came had the wrong return address on the envelope. So that is why you need to double check there. And I believe a couple months ago, some forms that voters received, and I'm not sure if it was from this group, were pre-filled out, and the NCSBE had to send out a warning about that. So that's why we need to make sure that everything is okay before you fill it out and send it in. But listen, voting by mail in North Carolina is safe. We've been doing it for years. Anyone can do it if they want to. You don't have to.
Okay. Is it secure in that if you slow down the mail, which essentially is what's happening, can it be effective and safe? Nick.
I was just about to say the biggest threat actually is the fact that the post office is currently dismantling itself by Louis DeJoy, who's lives in Greensboro or from Greensboro, who's now the postmaster general. And people should still request absentee ballots if that's how you want to vote, but you should do it early, right? Ballots start being mailed in September. Do it early and send it in early so that you can ensure your ballot has enough time to get back to the Board of Elections.
Nick Oxner from WBTV Channel 3, and Nick Oxner, Joe Bruno, rather, from WSSC-TV Channel 9, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News 1, and Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News. Thank you all. We leave you with this again this week. A fact is information minus emotion. An opinion is information plus experience. Ignorance is an opinion lacking information. And stupidity is an opinion that ignores facts. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.